Lecture 16, Hittites.
In this lecture, we continue to some degree the narrative from the last one, where we described the discovery of Minoan civilization. This time, we're going to look at the Hittites, who were one of the major players in the complex political world of the Eastern Mediterranean over 3,000 years ago. We're also going to look at this discovery in two ways. We're going to look at the discovery of a major site, and then we're going to look at it again through the prism of a single archaeologist's life. This is a lecture about the Hittites, who competed with the Assyrians and Egyptians in the Eastern Mediterranean in the 2nd millennium BC. Yet, until relatively recently, they remained little known, and it was Flinders Petrie's discovery of the Amarna tablets in Egypt in 1891 that really put the Hittites on the map. This lecture shows how archaeology filled in many details of this shadowy civilization. In the first part, we describe the discovery of the Hittite capital at Boghos Koi and the significance of the Amarna tablets, to which we return once again. And then the second part introduces a major figure in 20th century archaeology, Englishman Leonard Woolley. His excavations at Hittite Carchemish on the Euphrates River gave an unrivaled picture of what archaeology was like in the Mediterranean world a century ago. Woolley had the gift of telling stories, and he paints a wonderful, if flamboyant, picture of conditions in the field in those remote days. And remote they are from us today, because archaeology was totally different from what it is now. First, let's say a couple of words about the Hittite civilization itself. The Hittite civilization, whose homeland is what is now Turkey, rose to prominence about 1650 BC. The Hittites themselves, their origins somewhat obscure, were traders and expert warriors. Their state soon rose to prominence in the cockpit of competing kingdoms, all vying for control of the Eastern Mediterranean shoreline with its strategic trade routes and ports which connected the Eastern world to Crete, the Aegean, and Egypt. Trade between these various areas had been going on for thousands of years. Now the pace intensified, and the competition for control also intensified. The Hittites were major players. They became even more major players when they mastered the technology of iron smelting. They were the first to use iron technology on a large scale, somewhere in the middle of the 2nd millennium BC, and they very carefully controlled the secret because they were well aware of its strategic advantage, because iron gives a much cheaper, much tougher working edge for weapons than bronze, which of course was the currency for armies of the day. So they were formidable competitors. But they were virtually unknown until 1906, except for passing references in the Old Testament. And yet, there were traces of them around. As early as the 1830s, travellers reported monumental ruins, large stone structures, at a place called Boghos Koi in central Turkey. In 1893, when archaeologists finally got round to do a little digging there, cuneiform tablets in an unknown script, unknown language, came from the site. Intrigued by these tablets, a German archaeologist named Hugo Winkler began major excavations at Boghos Koi in 1906. This, remember, was one of the last major early civilizations in the Eastern Mediterranean that had not been investigated at all. So it's hardly surprising that he made fairly spectacular discoveries. He uncovered the remains of a large stone-walled palace. And in addition, he found thousands of clay tablets. Now you'll recall that Flinders Petrie at El Amarna capital of the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten, discovered the Amarna archives. You'll also recall that I told you that Babylonian cuneiform was the lingua franca of diplomacy in the day, because these states, competitors as they were, obviously were constantly communicating, and they needed some form of common communication or some script to do so. And cuneiform, which was widely used, was the most logical. When Winckler came to examine his archives from Bogoskoy, he discovered that some of the tablets bore Babylonian cuneiform. Soon deciphered, they proved to be the correspondence between the king of Hatti, which is the Hittite kingdom, and the Egyptian pharaoh. This remarkable discovery allowed Winckler not only to identify Boghazkoi as the Hittite capital, but to throw a great deal of light on the ebb and flow of politics in this region during the second millennium BC, which you will remember was the time when Egypt's greatest pharaohs were at the height of their power, Ramesses II, Seti I. And in fact, it was Ramesses II who had a memorable confrontation with the Hittites at the Battle of Kadesh. During his first season at Boghazkoy, Winckler found a tablet bearing the text of a peace treaty between the Hittites and the Egyptian pharaoh, Ramesses II. And what was remarkable about this was that it was a word-for-word copy of a treaty between the Egyptians and the Hittites, known from an inscription on the wall of the temple of the sun god Amun at Karnak in Thebes. So here was confirmation that this sort of diplomacy was two-sided, and that there really was a peace treaty. The purpose of this peace treaty after the Battle of Kadesh was simply, in a way, to divide up the disputed territory in a way, because both sides realized that it was counterproductive to fight when they could each carve out a piece of territory for each other and live on amicable terms. And this treaty actually held for a considerable time. The Winckler expedition, in the end, recovered more than 10,000 tablets. But it was not until 1915 that the Hittite script was deciphered. This is different from Babylonian cuneiform. I'm talking about Hittite script. But the Boghazkoi tablets were a major discovery because they allowed scholars to assess much more thoroughly the significance of the El Amarna diplomatic archive found by Flinders Petrie in 1891-2. The Amarna and Boghazkoi tablets reveal a diplomatic world of great complexity. This, as I said in the Flinders Petrie lecture, was a game of diplomatic chess. It was complicated by lack of its immediacy. One of the things we forget about the ancient world is that communication wasn't instant by internet, email, or telephone. It took weeks. So the game was played very deliberately as a constant game of one-upmanship, using strategic pawns of every kind. The Egypt's major tool, as I told you before, was gold. And as long as Egypt had gold, it had a position of considerable strength, because then, as now, gold had enormous power, economic, prestigious, and diplomatic. The game of force clearly didn't work between these two players, although there were constant fights on the frontier. And really, what was going on, more than anything else, was the use of a lot of intermediate pawns. Small kingdoms run by petty chiefs would change sides according to the bribes they got, And a lot of this correspondence revolves around chiefs asking for help, minor kings asking for help, who wanted protection against the Hittites or against the Egyptians. And you can really get a sense of this very complex, volatile seesaw of loyalties that was going on. It was a world that was corrupt, cynical, given to public blandishment and ruthless backdoor dealing. The Egyptians held the trump card, gold, which was envied throughout the ancient world. In fact, it's very interesting that when Egypt began to get short of gold in the late period, its diplomatic influence declined almost immediately. Strategic diplomatic marriage of foreign chiefdoms or foreign princesses to the pharaohs was constantly practiced, although, as I said before, Egyptian princesses never left Egypt. The tablets were a major discovery because they made us realize how much more complex the ancient world was than we had realized. Now we were beginning to look not at just civilizations, but civilizations that were linked in ways, whether they liked it or not, which meant that you had to negotiate, sometimes you had to fight, and frequently you competed with trade. And the other thing that was going on became more and more important was a rapid growth in international trade, the culture of the caravan. The Hittites maintained regular contacts with Assyria and with Egypt, and a network of expanding caravan routes, many of them negotiated by caravans of black donkeys, heavily laden, crisscrossed the land-borne areas of the Near East. And those who traveled in those caravans looked neither to the left or the right. They traveled through hostile territory. They traveled through deserts because the mechanisms of trade continued whatever the disputes between kings and states. So you get this undercurrent of more and more, today we would call it globalization, I suppose you could call it that then, where the whole of the ancient world was interconnected with ties, many of which were very inconspicuous, and many of which were economically of vital importance, because one of the myths of early civilizations is that only any civilization can be completely self-supporting. They can't be. They rely on others. So as a result, the power of trade became more and more. But it was not until the first millennium AD, and late in that, when people domesticated the camel in South Arabia, and this is even more important, they developed the camel saddle to carry loads, and a camel saddle from which you could fight, that the caravan culture really became all important, because then those who controlled the caravans and the caravan routes had enormous political power. But here you just begin to see the beginnings of this interconnection intensifying as it did in the second and first millennium BC. We realize now, and the tablets made it very clear, that the world of the Hittites and the Egyptians and Hatti and Mitanni and the Assyrians was as complex and ever-changing as our own, governed in large part by the motivations of individuals and special groups, by kings and their courts. A fascinating, very complex mosaic of competition and warfare and diplomacy was revealed by the tablets at Boguskoi and Amarna. While the Germans excavated Boguskoi, other European powers and their museums were casting covetous eyes not only on the remains of the Turkish Empire in Syria and Mesopotamia, but on the archaeological sites there. This area, then as now, was very strategically important. The Germans were flexing their diplomatic muscles in Europe. And in the early years of the 20th century, they began to build a railroad from southern Turkey to Baghdad. Now you'll recall that Claudius James Rich, in the early 19th century, was appointed the British resident in Baghdad precisely because the British realized the strategic importance of the overland route to India. And clearly, an expansive Germany building a railroad from Turkey to Baghdad clearly posed a potential strategic threat. And it's no coincidence that Turkey in the end was drawn into World War I. And this caused concern in Britain for obvious reasons, because they were concerned as much as they were in the 19th century with the Russian expansion through Afghanistan, they were now concerned with German expansion, controlling this overland route. Now it so happened that this railroad passed close to an ancient Hittite city, the city of Carchemish, which lay at a critical ford over the Euphrates River. And this site brings onto the stage of the discovery of the civilizations one of the most colorful and fascinating and gifted characters ever to take an archaeologist's trowel into his hand, Englishman Leonard Woolley. Leonard Woolley was the younger son of a moderately prosperous family. He went up to Oxford University with the intention of becoming a clergyman. In his final year, the president, or rather the warden, I should say to be precise, of his college at Oxford summoned him and said, "Ah, yes, Woolley, what are you going to do when you go down from Oxford?" And Woolley murmured something about becoming a schoolteacher or a parson. And the warden looked at him and his wonderful English voice said, "Woolley, I have decided that you will become an archaeologist." And Woolley did, which was very lucky for archaeology, because Woolley had extraordinary talents as an archaeologist. He took to it as if he had done it since birth. He learnt it the way that early 20th century archaeologists learnt their craft, not with long degree programs and tiresome requirements and field schools, but by simply going out to dig with other people. His first dig, where he was left largely alone, was on the Roman Wall, Hadrian's Wall, which divided England, Roman England, from, or Roman Britain, I should say, from Scotland. This was little more than a casual fossick. Then he went out and worked in the Sudan, among others with the American archaeologist George Wisner, who we'll meet later on. There, he learnt not only how to dig burials and how to dig on large sites, but he also managed large numbers of local workers, which, if you worked in the Near East on any scale, was a critically important skill to learn. He gained some Arabic and loved the people and the life. In 1912, he was at a loose end. And the British Museum, who had started work in 1911 with an archaeologist called David Hogarth at Carchemish — Hogarth was famous for his bad temper before breakfast and was known to his workers as the Angel of Death, but he was a very competent archaeologist — they brought in Leonard Woolley to succeed him. At this time, Woolley was totally unknown. He was to gain world fame for his discoveries at Biblical Ur in the 1920s, which we describe later in this course. But his experiences at Carchemish are a wonderful mirror of what excavation was like in this area on the frontiers of what even then was the well-known world in the early 20th century. Fortunately for us, Woolley was a storyteller. He exaggerated his stories, but they have the wonderful panache and snap of a genuine after-dinner story. So we know quite a lot of what it was like. He worked at Carchemish with one other European with a background in pottery and photography, a man called T.E. Lawrence. He was later to acquire fame or even notoriety as Lawrence of Arabia. But here he was working, having worked in a little bit in archaeology in Oxford, as Woolley's assistant. He'd worked as Hogarth's assistant. And the two men got on very well. They built themselves a beautiful mud brick excavation house, which was designed carefully so if the worst came to the worst and they were attacked, they could defend it with their rifles. And they worked with dozens of Arab labourers, people who were really at each other's throats a lot. The factionalism and the tribal rivalries in this area were notorious. But Woolley realized how to handle them. The first thing he realized, he followed a rule which Claudius James Rich had followed a century before, where Rich, the diplomat in Baghdad, had said, "Only the most decisive behavior will do." He acted like a leader. And he behaved with great high-handedness and decidedness. His men adored him, particularly when he made local Turkish officials who tried to hinder the excavations foolish. And the way he did it was brutal. On one occasion, he had trouble with a local official over getting a permit signed. So Woolley went into his office, demanded his permit, and when the man prevaricated, produced a revolver and held it to the man's ear and said, "Sign, please." And he did. Now, today you could never do that. The forces of nationalism and so on. But in those days, the British Empire spread from Cape to Cairo. Much of the world was painted the red of the British Empire. And Woolley knew perfectly well, which actually took some courage, that if he behaved high-handedly and there was trouble, a gunboat would be there very quickly. And they would be punished, those who had punished him. And he behaved accordingly. He got away with it because he was dealing with weak rulers or local officials who are constantly accountable to Constantinople. The bureaucracy was ponderous, slow-moving, and communications were still slow. So he got away with it. At the same time, he hired a man called Hammoudi, who became his foreman. And they developed a lifelong friendship which endured all the time that Woolley excavated archaeological sites. And Woolley loved this man. He was a genius at leading men. It was he who had the brilliant idea at Ur many years later, when they were shifting enormous quantities of earth, of employing a musician to sing and play canoe songs so that the men dug in rhythm, in unison. It was he who damped down feuds, and this man was known to have murdered several people. He is said to have had only two passions in his life: archaeology and violence. So this was a pretty formidable character. And the two of them, both of them had a good line of speak, really ran that excavation. They ran it as a sort of game. At the same time, it is believed that the Foreign Office had Woolley keeping an eye on the Germans, and that he was part of the great game of spying, which the British had done with the Russians from India, and now maybe they were doing here. This is disputed, but it seems possible that Woolley was also keeping an eye on the Germans. He certainly gave them a lot of trouble. For example, to reach the Hittite city at Carchemish, he had to remove the Roman fortifications. What did he do? He sold the stone from the Roman fortifications to the Germans, who were building the railroad bed nearby. At the same time, on an occasion, he had to mediate labor disputes with the Germans and their workers because they hadn't a clue how to handle the local people, and the local people would come to him and say, we have a problem. So he really could keep a pretty good eye on them. And underneath the Roman fortifications, he found a powerful Hittite community which had flourished for more than 200 years. The finds were superb. A magnificent processional way leading up from the river, adorned with the scenes of a triumphal army treading on its vanquished enemies. Sculpture, numerous artifacts. We learned from this a great deal about an outlying Hittite city. But from the point of view of the discovery of the ancient civilizations, really the most important lesson that came out of Carchemish was for Woolley. It was there that he learned how to organize a large-scale excavation and how to handle large teams of people. Sometimes he used what today would be considered absurd gimmicks. For example, whenever an important find was made, he would allow his men to release a salvo of rifle fire. This, he said, was really a good strategy. The whole thing may seem childish, he wrote, but in fact it is such things that make the work go well. And when digging ceases to be a great game and becomes, as in Egypt, a mere business, it will be a bad thing. Sometimes I think that we take archaeology today a little too seriously, because Woolley had, and he was deeply serious about archaeology, let us make no mistake, he had a lovely light touch, which made all the difference and helped him control a labor force as they made great discoveries. He also mastered another skill, the skill of being able to write vividly about his finds. This skill was vital at Ur when he made discoveries of worldwide importance, had to raise money, and one way to do it was to appeal to a captivated public. This was a very different sort of publicity than that used by Schliemann, who was self-justifying. Here, Woolley was engaged in the more modern activity of fundraising. The Carchemish excavations are fascinating. If you read Woolley's reminiscences of them, and we give you the reference in the course guide, they helped reveal much about the Hittite civilization and its role in a world of constant diplomacy and war. But more importantly than that, from our point of view, these excavations reveal in microcosm a cozy world of archaeology before World War I. It was still an adventurous but more and more academic pastime, at times almost a formalized game, but also a fledgling science. The number of professional archaeologists was teeny. Everybody knew everybody else. Many of them still had a grounding in classical literature, and there were certainly no formal degree programs in prehistoric archaeology. You learnt as you went along. It was assumed that you would mostly dig with large numbers of native people. It was assumed that many of the finds would return to the museum that was financing you. But above all, you were the only foreigner, or one or two of you, way out miles from anywhere. You were alone. It was still a very solitary activity. And if you look at Woolley's career as it went on, it followed a pattern. We enlisted in the army in World War I, fought the Turks in Mesopotamia, was captured and became a prisoner of war, about which he wrote an interesting book. It wasn't too bad an experience. And then after the war, he went on to much bigger and greater things. The excavation of Ur, sponsored by two major museums, in charge of hundreds of men with only a handful of professional archaeologists with him. But a world that was changing rapidly. What kept him going and what enabled him to make a brilliant success of this, even if his records were poor by today's standards, was his experience in a much simpler archaeological world, among the Hittites at Carchemish, working only with T.E. Lawrence and one trusted native foreman. This was the secret of many of the great archaeologists, their ability to work alone, miles from anywhere, and to gain the trust of the local people.